This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 347 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is Rob Mark. He's a pilot, a flight instructor, an aviation journalist, and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
347?
Can you believe it? I know.
I remember when we went through the first 100 and people said, "Are you people crazy?" Obviously, the fact that we're still here 247 episodes later answers that question. So good evening to everybody.
Also joining us is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, a glass cockpit expert. Hey, Max.
Hello, Max Flight. How are you doing? And just want to mention I was close to both of you gentlemen this week.
I took a
commercial flight that changed planes in O'Hare. So I didn't see Rob. I looked all over the airport there, didn't see him. And then ended up in Danbury, Connecticut, which I guess is less than an hour from where you're located. And then spent the next, 40 days and 40 nights flying a Cirrus back. It's just we had massive headwinds, but it was a great fun flight. Brought it back here to California, and have posted some photos from that. And we'll tell folks later where to find those.
Right. Now, you didn't encounter any difficulties that you couldn't deal with?
You know, we didn't once get searched by the TSA, so it was a good flight.
Wonderful.
But do you ever think along the way how much faster it would have been to be going from California back to Danbury?
Oh gosh. I mean, the first day we started off with 51 knot headwinds, and it dropped to 40 by the end of the day. So I would say we averaged over 30 knot headwinds the entire 2.5 days and 21.6 hours in the SR-22.
Well, we wanted to mention David Vanderhoof, our other co-host, today, actually, this morning, as we record this. David had his surgery, and he's out. He's recovering now. Rob, it sounds like David came out pretty well.
Well, I did try to tell him, though. I mean, you know, David wouldn't listen to me, even though we harangued Michelle that, you know, we could have saved them some money if they had just allowed me to come to Philly and help with the operation. But for some reason, you know, he just didn't seem to be real keen on that. No, seriously, well, we're really glad David's out of the woods for today. All we're going to do is get him out of the hospital now. We're really glad that he's, well, we assume he's feeling better. We haven't actually talked to him yet, have we?
No, we haven't. I think they're letting him sleep now. I understand he's going to be in the hospital for, well, several days anyway, before he's able to go home and then continue his recovery there. So we all wish David well. We know David's listening to, well, he's not listening to this now, but he will be shortly, I am sure. And so we really anticipate David's return. All right. Well, let's introduce our guest for this episode. It's Captain Vince Donahue. He's the founder and president of Vortex UAS. Now, Vortex provides tailored solutions, really, for businesses utilizing unmanned aircraft systems, UAS, including pilot training, consulting, and other UAS services. Now, Vince has been a professional pilot for over a decade. Presently, he's the chief pilot of a corporate flight department. He has 4 type ratings in airline, charter, corporate aviation, and he's a CFI. Vince, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to being your guest today.
Now, you've got quite a background. You were a naval flight officer, as I understand it, aboard the USS Midway and USS Independence in Squadron VAW 115. Now, tell us about what a VAW is.
VAW means fixed wing, And AW means Airborne Early Warning. So we would fly the E-2C Hawkeye, and the mission of the E-2C was to fly above and in front of the battle group and have a radar overall picture of several miles that would give the commanders back at the battle center, back on the carrier, an overall picture of what was going on. This way, if there was an enemy attack launched, that the battle group would have a longer lead time and know that they were coming and be able to launch aircraft to intercept the fighters that were coming in to destroy the battle group.
And you flew a number of operations, sorties, I guess, in Desert Storm?
Yes, I was involved in Desert Shield and Desert Storm, as you say, on the USS Midway, which is now a museum in San Diego. And then we swapped out. We were actually forward deployed to Japan. We flew out of a Tsugi base, and the carrier was in Yokosuka, Japan. And as I was halfway through my deployment there with VAW-115 and the carrier Air Wing 5, we sailed back and swapped out aircraft carriers with the USS Independence. And then we sailed back with our same air wing on that, the USS Independence, back to forward deployed location in Japan.
All right. Well, we're really fascinated to hear coming up the story of how you started or went from that to founding an unmanned aircraft company. And of course, this is something that we love to talk about. David and I also do the UAV Digest podcast that focuses on that. But we wanted to bring Vince in here to talk about these things from the perspective of, well, of a pilot, of a real pilot. Wouldn't you say, Rob, a real pilot?
I was going to ask you about what a real pilot is, but we'll find that out later, I bet.
Okay. Also coming up, we have an Australia Desk report. It turns out that the guys thought that last week was a bits and pieces episode. That turns out to be why we didn't have one last week, but they come through this time. Rob, you've also got an aviation minute for us, don't you?
I do this week, and this week we're going to talk about airports. I know everybody thinks that's really boring, but I have a few ideas about how airports might actually help us get the aviation industry out of some of the slump that it's still in.
All right. Can't wait to hear that. We also have some listener feedback, just a little bit of the large amount of listener feedback that we've received in the past week or so. So we'll try to get to as much of that as we can coming up as well. First, though, let's get started with the aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
I'm ready.
Ready!
Our first story comes from nextgov.com. This is Fed's heightened scrutiny of TSA screeners and aviation staff to thwart insider threat. Now, you may remember a little while ago we talked about that story where guns were being smuggled aboard a Delta flight from Atlanta to New York. And in that case, the folks involved were, well, staff in and around the airport. Well, now the TSA says they're going to implement some increased electronic surveillance. And boy, they are not fooling around. So there's some things that are going to happen immediately and some things that I guess are still being looked at or are in the future. Effective immediately, random screening of airline employees during the day, during the workday, are going to be conducted, as well as biennial criminal history checks. Now, the TSA is hoping to replace those kind of checks with some kind of a system that allows them to check, I guess, more in real time. They call it real-time recurrent FBI background checks for all aviation workers. So, I mean, especially after that story and in our conversations, our discussion about the, sort of the, well, the vulnerability that's possible with the credentials that airport workers have and the fact that they're really not in many cases screened to any great degree. Rob, what do you think?
No.
It makes no sense to you?
Oh, you know, I disagree that airline employees are not really screened. I mean, they all go through background checks, at least to the best of my knowledge. So if one of our listeners has something else that they can, some additional light they can shed on this. But I mean, to my knowledge, they all go through background checks. They carry ID cards that are not the only way to get through a door. You need the ID card to be scanned, and you still need to punch in a code to get through a secure door. And I don't know. I mean, the trouble is that the whole damned industry is still as reactive as it was 20 years ago. It's just that the threats are a little different. And every time we find a hole, we go, oh, got to patch that one. Wow. We're fixed now until the next one comes along. Well, that was the end of my comment, actually.
I was going to say, it's about time. This has been a hole big enough, I think, to drive a freight truck through. You know, I think we've been talking about this since 9/11, where, you know, possibly, you know, those blade cutters got put on to an airplane by somebody who was not on those airplanes, but, you know, working at an airport. I think it's just about time. I think this has been a huge hole, and I'm happy to see that they're increasing the scrutiny of airport workers. I know that just like the passengers, 99.999, you know, percent of the people are not threats. But, sure. You know, I think this makes sense.
And some of the privacy activists are, well, more than a little concerned about this. The TSA is saying that they might actually monitor social media communications of employees at airports. So I guess that means watching what they say on Facebook and Twitter and seeing if that, you know, indicates that somebody has some thoughts about what they may do that represent a threat. Just checking employees against additional watch lists is something else that the TSA is looking at.
Nah, they don't have time to do that. They don't have the personnel to watch. What communications would they even watch, even if wanted to?
But they could automate it, right? You use a watch list of words and just run it against a Twitter feed of everybody. So, yeah, I think they can automate that.
I mean, they picked up on that one guy who was recently tweeting about hacking into and we're going to talk about this coming up, but hacking into the IFE system on an airplane. And he was met by the authorities, and United told him that he couldn't board the next flight he was on. I think it was a joke, but I mean, somebody picked up on that. But you're right, Rob. I mean, the volume of communications on social media is enormous. And so as a practical matter, I don't know how they do that.
No. And you know, honestly, I'm not saying that, you know, more security may not be necessary, as Max West said, but I'm just saying that the enormity of the task of going from, you know, 98.9% secure to 99.9% secure is going to be just enormous.
Hmm. Vince, any thoughts on this? Does this resonate with you?
Well, I remember as I was finishing up my stint at American Eagle, where I started out as a first officer on the CRJ 700, they were implementing biometrics at the time, and I believe that should be fully implemented at this point. Now, of course, I was a pilot and my wife is a pilot currently with a major airline. So clearly the scrutiny amongst pilots is they're looked at pretty thoroughly, as you could imagine, and very well vetted over the course of many years. The average airport worker, I don't know if they need more scrutiny or not. I think maybe with line personnel falling asleep in the back of the cargo hold of aircraft, maybe more could be done to look into, you know, the security of the actual aircraft.
Hmm. Well, these recommendations come from a committee report, actually. It's from a Department of Homeland Security Aviation Security Advisory Committee report. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. But, I mean, Rob, if you think that monitoring social media is kind of a task, they also talk about, this is a quote from the report, CCTV monitoring, video analytics, or predictive analytical software would focus on anomalies, behavior patterns, carriage of bags, etc. So it's, you know, we see this kind of high-tech approach. I mean, this is sort of the hallmark of the TSA. Let's spend a lot of money on technology, and maybe it makes a difference, maybe it doesn't. So as I say, we'll put a link to the report in the show notes, and if you want to kind of dig into that deeper, you're more than welcome. Our next story, this comes from Gizmag. U.S. Navy goes tubular with autonomous swarming UAV demonstrations. Now, this is kind of interesting. This comes from the Office of Naval Research. They've been demonstrating swarming UAVs. This is under the LOCUST program. Of course, they have an interesting acronym. That stands for Low-Cost UAV Swarming Technology. That gives you LOCUST, which is a great name for a swarming UAV program. The idea is that this LOCUST system launches a group of drones with these tube launchers, hence the tubular in the article title. But it's a kind of a compact system. They say it can be used on ships, on tactical vehicles, or aircraft. And once they're airborne, this group of drones, the idea is they share information and collaborate autonomously for both defensive and offensive missions. A pretty interesting kind of approach. Vince, we've seen examples of swarming UAVs in other contexts. This is the Navy's take on that. What do you think?
I think the swarming technology is just amazing. The autonomy that it implements allows, as the acronym says, the low-cost aspect of it, where you're having you're diversifying the risk of any one drone being shot down or destroyed or not being able to complete the mission, and the mission still goes on, whereas you have one large predator or global hawk that's out to complete a mission. You lose that asset, you're losing, you know, $30 million or $50 million. Now, how they're tasked is, I'm not really sure or clear about how they're being tasked, whether they each have some kind of small explosive device or some kind of projectile that they can use once they hit the target. But the concept of splitting the liability or the risk on each individual aircraft is really beneficial. And from if you're being attacked by a swarm, I mean, just think of being, you know, swarmed by a bunch of bees,
right?
And you have how much mass compared to a single bee. But they will dominate just out of a fear factor. You'll just turn and run just looking at a swarm coming at you. So there's you know, could be a psychological weapon as well. You know, you have those, that overwhelming swarm coming at you, I think would freak anybody out.
Yes, absolutely. And what they're using here, well, at least in the demonstrations they've conducted, are these Coyote UAVs. And these are, they're about a meter long, fixed wing. The wings fold. They're electric powered. They have about a 90-minute endurance, and they can reach an altitude of 20,000 feet. So they're pretty small, and I would imagine that a collection of those, you mentioned the, you know, a predator or a reaper or something of that class, that a collection of something small like this is going to cost a lot less than one of those big guys.
Right, and be able to do maybe as much damage and then move on to the next target. And even if you have 20% loss at each event, you still have a lot of drones left and you can still do a lot of damage even after, you know, say three or four different engagements.
Are they assuming they're going to recover these things, or are they just sending them out on a sort of a, you know, one-way mission?
One-way mission? Yeah, that's a great question, Rob. I didn't see that mentioned. I could envision that these could possibly be, you know, treated as expendable and just go on a one-way mission. I didn't see any reference to them returning and how you'd, you know, capture them or return them into service.
Well, it also suggests a combined and shared intelligence where they could have a certain number of landing fields and gathering points where they could, again, share the information and say, okay, well, this is a safe landing point and all decide to gather there. Even if you have some stragglers that fall behind, You could have, you know, all land in the same field, and then you have some C-130 that comes picks them up.
Ah, okay. This swarming technology is amazing. I have no idea how this is implemented, you know, in software and through the use of sensors. But as I mentioned, it is something that we have seen a number of examples of. And I'm sure that there are many interesting commercial applications for this, as you know, as well as military. So this definitely bears watching.
It seems a little reminiscent of the ballistic missiles back in probably the 80s, the MIRVs, the multiply independent targetable reentry vehicles. I mean, that concept was similar in the sense that you would have 10, 20, however many warheads in a single missile, some of which were actually dummy warheads, which would, you know, presumably prevent an enemy from destroying all of them or detecting until it was too late which of the reentering warheads were real and which were not. But on the Coyote UAVs, I just have to wonder, you know, were these invented by the Acme company, you know, the Roadrunner? I mean, and if these things don't come back, you know, I would say watch out for them.
Oh, I had a different version of how they were going to recover them, though. I just assumed that they'd put the, you know, a bunch of junior flight officers on the back end of the boat with big nets, and then they would just buzz by and they'd try and grab them in the net on the way back.
Well, you know, Rob, there are possible. Yes, it is quite possible. There are some drone recovery systems that work exactly that way, that there's a net that goes up stretched across some poles, and the drone flies into the net and you've caught it.
And there are net guns available. I saw one demonstrated recently. It's kind of an anti-drone technology where you fire it at the drone and the net wraps around it and brings it down.
Yes. And in fact, I understand that they had those available during the recent Boston Marathon. They used some a system that actually listens for the characteristic sound of drones, of quadcopters and things. This was a security measure for the Boston Marathon. And that the police, if they detected that, because they had declared Boston to be a no-fly zone for drones during the marathon, that they actually had some of these net guns that they were going to use. But they didn't need to deploy them because there were no incursions by rogue drones. All right. Well, hey, let's move on and talk about Delta Airlines. We see in Aviation Week that Delta Airlines senior instructors are going to be sent to upset prevention and recovery training. This is going to include ground instruction, in-aircraft instruction, and simulator instruction. And the airline Delta wants their pilots to better avoid or recover from loss of control incidents. What is all this about? I mean, why is Delta taking this action now?
Well, I can jump in on that one because I'm familiar with this program and this company, Aviation Performance Solutions out in Mesa, Arizona, is the one that got the contract from Delta. And unfortunately for us in the aviation industry, loss of control, little airplanes and big airplanes, is still the number one producer of fatalities in the aviation industry. And so what between ICAO in Montreal and the FAA here in the States and a few other groups, they're trying not to just come up with ways to show people how to recover should they lose control of the airplane. They're trying to teach them the clues that they need to be aware of long before they ever lose control of the airplane. And that's no small problem. It's much harder to do than we think it is, because no matter what we seem to try, people still keep losing control of the airplane. Delta decided to bring their senior instructors out to go through the APS program in Mesa, and it's really an interesting class. It runs for a couple of days. I went through it a few years back, and they fly you in an Extra, which is an aerobatic airplane. And if you haven't done any aerobatics and you're not familiar with the roll rate alone, Vince might be, having come from, you know, the Navy, but the roll rate in an Extra is just mind-boggling. I mean, you push the stick one way and you've done about three rolls before you even realize you've started. So it's very maneuverable, and they try to take you out and show you some of the situations you can get yourself into if you're not paying attention. And that course follows up on the ground school they give you, and then we go back into the simulator and try and see some of those examples and try some of the recoveries in a transport category simulator. So it's a all-encompassing program. And then the Delta instructors are going to go take it back to their simulator sessions and teach the Delta pilots what they've learned.
Oh, yeah. So it's a train-the-trainer kind of program.
Absolutely.
Vince, did you ever receive this kind of training, either commercial or military?
Well, in the military, during our initial training back at VT-10 at Pensacola, we did fly ACM, what we call air combat maneuvers. So that involved dogfighting simulation. But that was the extent of mine. And that's when I realized early on that, maybe I'm not cut out for the F-14 after all, because I didn't do too well. Used up the bags on a couple of those flights.
Oh, dear.
But, on an E-2C, we didn't do a lot of snap rolls. The radar dome would have fallen into the sea had we done that. So we were pretty mellow. I think a lot of the time we were limited to maybe a 15-degree bank angle to keep that radar actually on what we needed to keep it on. So, yeah, we all go through that training as Navy either pilots or, as I was, a naval flight officer. And it was great. I loved it.
Do you think maybe Delta is looking at this as the first step toward putting their own flight performance team together, like the Blue Angels using 757s and things like that? I mean, if they could roll a 707 back at Boeing Field years ago, I mean, they ought to be able to do that today.
Yeah. It's a lot of blue paint.
Yeah.
All right. Another story we have from Wired.com. Feds warn airlines to look out for passengers hacking jets. Now, this is a topic that's been, in the news media, in the traditional media, as well as in the aviation press. The concerns have, I guess, escalated that airliners might be vulnerable to hacking. Now, a couple of things have happened. The U.S. Government Accountability Office issued a report saying that some of the newer passenger jets, like the 787, the Airbus A350 and A380, that they have Wi-Fi networks for the passengers that share the same network as the avionics systems of the planes. Concern being that if there's no air gap, if you will, between them, that someone could hack into the plane's systems. And then the FBI and the TSA have issued an alert to airlines advising them to watch out for certain kinds of behavior, certain kinds of activity. You know, there's a lot of conversation, as I say, about this topic. In fact, in the recent Airline Pilot Guy podcast, Captain Jeff talked about this in episode 164. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And one of his points that kind of came out from that conversation was that, you know, we're seeing a lot of people who have no computer background claiming that this hacking is possible, and you have people that have no real aviation background saying this kind of hacking is possible, and that, you know, where are the experts in both fields that can either say that this is a threat or not? I know what my view is on it. Rob, what do you think? Do we have something to be worried about?
Well, it's very interesting that we're talking about this week, because the Chicago Area Business Aviation Association, CABA, which is the sort of the local BizAv pilot maintenance technician group here in Chicago, had our safety day last week. And we had a guy from the FAA, Peter Scaves, who I can't even begin to remember Peter's exact title, but he's the guy at the FAA that deals with avionics on transport category aircraft, and looks at exactly this issue. And he spoke to us about just this issue. And because honestly, like everybody else, I wondered myself. And I he doesn't strike me as an alarmist, but he also didn't strike me as someone, I think he was at GE for many years before he came to the FAA. But, you know, he looked at it from a very pragmatic kind of perspective. They're looking into the possibility of any kind of a threat, but also that, let's be serious, there are redundancies in our system. It's not like somebody in row 27, seat F, is going to suddenly hack into the Wi-Fi on a 777 and take control of the airplane, and the crew is just going to sit there in the cockpit and go, huh, look at that, Fred. Somebody's yeah. flying the airplane. Hmm, wonder where it's going now. You know, it's just not going to happen unless the crew, unless the crew is, you know, for some reason incapable of knowing what's going on. And you could certainly, you know, there's all kinds of redundancies. The system architecture on an airplane is a very closed system. It does not typically accept input from the internet like your iPad does or anything like that, so that there are lots of attack points or anything along those lines. But then again, you know, and his final thought was that, hey, you know what? Turn off the auto flight system if the airplane's trying to go someplace you don't want it to go. Hmm. So, you know, I'm not saying it couldn't happen. And while I don't always believe everything the FAA tells me, I don't know. You know, it kind of made sense to me. But Vince, you were there too. I don't know. Did you come away with a different thought, perhaps?
My thought was that, well, the pilots, whether they're uploading a flight plan or a change in the flight plan, they need to actually put it in. They need to put that into the FMS, the flight management system, and activate it. So, as you said, Rob, it would take pilots who are completely disengaged from what's going on in the cockpit to allow anything like that happen. And I don't know of any system that's so integrated where somebody could hack into the Wi-Fi and actually fly the plane. I believe that there is some kind of human input that's required in any cockpit that I know of anyway. Maybe, you know, there are newer systems that I don't know of, but you need to have some kind of human interface with that system for the pilots to say, okay, yeah, this is what we want to do, and hit enter and hit nav and to fly that flight program. So that's why I don't think currently it's that much of a risk. That's from what I understand right now.
Well, the alert that the FBI and TSA issued, it kind of provides some clues as to at least how they're thinking about this. The report says in one part, although the media claims remain theoretical and unproven, the media publicity associated with these statements may encourage actors to use the described intrusion methods. And then they point to four signs that they say that flight crews should be looking for. The first is suspicious activity involving travelers connecting unknown cables or wires to the IFE system or unusual parts of the airplane seat. The second one is any evidence of suspicious behavior following a flight, such as IFE systems that show evidence of tampering or the forced removal of covers to network connection ports. The third one is any evidence of suspicious behavior concerning aviation wireless signals, including social media messages with threatening references to onboard network systems, ADS-B, ACARS, and air traffic control networks. And then the final fourth sign that flight crews should look for is that they should review network logs from aircraft to ensure any suspicious activity, such as network scanning or intrusion attempts, is captured for further analysis. That sounds like a lot of incremental work, doesn't it?
Well, I think the thing people should really be watching for, if you're sitting back in the cabin and the person next to you starts whipping out a set of alligator clips, start, you know, trying to hack into some wires, you know, that's probably a sign that something untoward is going on. But I look at Chris Roberts' tweet, find myself on the 737/800. Let's see, box-IFE-ISC-SATCOM ? Shall we start playing with ICAS messages? Pass oxygen on anyone? I mean, it's really kind of funny because most people, including me, would read it and go, what? But it turns out, you know, he had done research years before on this ICAS, the engine indicating crew alert system, and, you know, had talked about vulnerabilities in that system, allowing someone to deploy a plane's oxygen mask. And you just wonder, was, you know, he someone who was being watched because of that? Because I can't imagine you know, TSA randomly coming across this particular tweet unless they were already watching for him. To me, the message seems kind of innocuous. And so I feel like they got overreacted a little bit. But, you know, I can understand why they want to look at every potential threat and cut it off. And United has basically said this guy can never fly with them again. So they're pretty serious about it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, my bottom line is, and I've talked about this with Mary Kirby on the PaxX podcast as well, is that unless there has to be an air gap between the IFE system that the passengers use and any other systems on the aircraft. Yeah, you can say that it would be virtually impossible to bridge the gap, even though there may be a firewall or some other method to keep them separated. But you know what? People find ways. We see it every day in the news. And, you know, you'd be surprised what you can hack. I mean, I don't know if I ever said this out loud, but, you know, once I hacked a Pepsi machine, you know, you can hack Pepsi machines by using the selector buttons for, you know, which drink you want. That's a keypad. And if you know what the code is to put in there, you can have the machine tell you how many cans are in the machine, how many have been sold. Inventory the machine. You can find out all kinds of information, but that's from a, you know, from a soda machine, you know, and that's just a simple system.
The opinions of the host are not endorsed by the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Just about take your retirement there, Max.
I won't say where the Pepsi machine was, but it was in East Hartford.
One comment that might be worth throwing. Now, again, I am only repeating what Peter Skase from the FAA told us the other day, is that the technology does exist on these closed systems aboard airplanes like the Airbus and the 777 and 787, that they can essentially alert someone to the fact that someone tried to hack them. Now, again, we may have technology geeks out there that are going to say, oh, that's baloney, that doesn't happen. I'm simply repeating what we were told. And, you know, again, that the boxes on the airplane run one piece of software, not multiple pieces of software. And again, that the backup is that the pilots do not have to sit back and let this thing do whatever it is that somebody wants it to do. Now, again, you may be right. I mean, maybe 5 years from now, we'll be looking at this saying, wow, how could we have been so stupid? But, you know, again, they're looking at it. That's about all we know right at this point.
I mean, on that note, you could, if you could tap into the ICAS system, you might be able to fool the pilots into thinking that there is an emergency happening, that the, you know, you have an engine fire, if you could get into the ICAS system. But if that's technologically possible, then I could see a cause of concern. But again, you'd have to have the pilots fooled into thinking that the plane was doing something that it shouldn't do. And as a pilot, you need to look at your backup indications and not just assume that an engine fire indication on the ICAS is an engine fire. You could call back and have the flight attendant, you know, look at the engine if that's possible. You look at the engine indicators, you know, look at your oil pressure, oil temperature, your ITT temperature. There are a lot of secondary indications, and you're not just going to cut an engine because there's one indication. So, you know, maybe that's possible, but you'd have to fool the pilots, I think, into thinking that there was something wrong.
Again, we're speaking with Vince Donahue. He's the president of Vortex UAS. Again, Vince, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks again. Thanks for having me. I'm enjoying it.
Maybe we should sort of baseline our listeners on where we are in the United States, principally, with unmanned aircraft systems. Do you want to kind of give a summary, Vince, talk about where the FAA is, the whole commercial use and the NPRM?
Sure. We're in a bit of a transition time. There are three really ways to use unmanned systems in the airspace. One is public entities, and those are governmental entities. The second is civil entities, like if, you know, Vortex UAS flying aircraft for a commercial purpose. And then there's hobbyists. So the rulemaking process, which is what we're in right now, the hobbyists are pretty much exempt. But hobbyists, you're going to take your remote control plane, go to an approved AMA field, fly it in that field up to 400 feet and within the confines of, the, of that airspace, and then pack up and go home when you're done. They are strictly hobbyists. It's for fun. Commercial entities like Vortex, UAS, we have to go through a process. And that process right now, the way that companies, and my last count was 99 companies were approved for Section 333 exemption. And that exemption, that Section 333 is part of the 2012 FAA Modernization and Reform Act of 2012. And this Section 333 gives the FAA the ability to kind of streamline and fast track companies that are going to implement the or use the unmanned systems in a way that it doesn't threaten the national airspace. And that's the FAA's concern. In fact, Mark Foisy, as Rob was saying, a gentleman from the FAA spoke at the CABA safety stand down on Thursday. And what he said, that the FAA is interested in the safe, efficient, and timely integration of UAS into the national airspace. So a lot of people would take issue with the efficient and timely because it has been a long, painful process. But they are certainly charged, legally charged, with the safe integration of unmanned systems into the airspace.
Yeah, I think we have a couple of different camps here. We have the, you know, the hobbyist, as you said, who sort of take the standpoint, and I think appropriately, you know, we figured out how to do this safely years ago. We do operate safely. You know, leave us alone. Let us do our hobbyist thing. Then you have, you could call them the technologists, or maybe I would call them that, people who have discovered the possibilities that unmanned aircraft present. We see lots of videos, incredible videos. That's just one example, but just using them for the tower inspections. Agriculture is just chomping at the bit to use these for crop surveys and things like that. There's disaster applications, medical, police, all these kinds of applications. They just want to get out there and use the technology. And then you have the people who are coming from, you know, the world of aviation, manned aviation, that say, well, that's nice and that's fine, except that we don't want to be up there hitting each other. And it's kind of a balancing act between these different groups.
It certainly is. And it's a difficult balancing act because everybody understands, anybody who's seen an aerial image or aerial footage of either a sporting event or a bell tower or anything from overhead, the Niagara Falls is a great video of the Niagara Falls on YouTube. The fireworks display that somebody uploaded to YouTube a month or two ago. These are incredible videos that you just drop your jaw in awe of what you can see, given that third dimension in looking down. And the ability to gather data on an astronomical rate. In fact, there's a lot of problems in the community with dealing with all this data. What do we do with all this data? How do we even store and transmit it? So the power is there. Everybody recognizes the power of this technology. But how do you do this safely? Now, I'm a professional pilot. My wife is a professional pilot. We all fly in commercial airlines. We don't want an unmanned aircraft to hit, or a commercial airline to hit a drone, an unmanned aircraft, and take it down and somebody get hurt, or a lot of people get hurt. Let's face it. You know, you talk about it won't be an efficient and timely integration of unmanned systems at that point if that happens. We don't want that. So we can't let that happen. And I'm looking at this from the FAA's perspective now, and I always wasn't that way. I was more of the, hey, come on, let's get a move on. And there is that cry in the community as well, because it has taken a tremendously long time in evolving this. But where we are now, so the Section 333 exemptions is a way to operate in the airspace right now. And Vortex UAS has applied for an exemption, and we're waiting to hear back, and maybe we'll receive it any day. And the companies that have received them are film companies using them for precision agriculture, using the unmanned systems for insurance companies, looking at damage, whether that's damage from weather or looking at roofs or accident scenes, and how they implement these their exemptions are yet to be seen, because it hasn't really this is all new. This is really brand new as of November that these 99 companies have received their exemptions, and there's maybe 10 or 20 that come out every other week. Now, the other factor is the NPRM, the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, that the FAA has put out. And that document, I would encourage everyone who is interested in this and to see how the FAA sees this whole legal regulatory structure evolving. They should really look at that document and you can project how the FAA sees this evolving. And they have operational limits that they've designed. For example, less than 55 pounds would be, these UAVs under 55 pounds would be qualified to operate within these rules. Visual line of sight. So the operator, they're calling the pilot an operator because they want to differentiate between unmanned systems and manned piloted systems. So the operator would need to be able to see at all times that unmanned aircraft, and with the naked eye or vision corrected eye. Daylight hours, no more than 100 miles per hour, no more than 500 feet. So still, we're talking about 500 feet and lower, and really what we're talking about is 400 feet and lower, because they like to keep that 100-foot buffer between what we can fly in planes and what the unmanned systems should be able to, their airspace that they want to fly in. Now, key to this is operators. What will operators need? Right now, you need a pilot's license. So whether that's recreational pilot, sport pilot, private pilot, and up, commercial pilot, ATP, that's what you need to fly, because you need to be certificated in order to operate in the national airspace, in order to participate in commerce. And because you're flying commercially, you're participating in commerce. So Vortex UAS is focused on working within the structure that the FAA is providing us. And also, what a lot of people aren't talking about is, how is insurance going to drive these costs and these requirements for unmanned pilots? What are their requirements going to be? So we are also working with insurance companies and soliciting them. Hey, what do you want to see? How do you want us to develop these programs? Because the threefold mission of Vortex UAS, one is pilot training. And that is a what we see is a booming need in this community, because let's face it, not a lot of people have even a recreational or a sport pilot's license. So we have a lot of manufacturers, a lot of exemption holders, but not a lot of people who can legally fly. So Vortex UAS is training those pilots. We also provide consultation for companies that want to maybe stand up their unmanned flight department. And then we're also going out in the field and collecting data. We provide services, in-field services as well. If somebody just doesn't want to deal with any of that and just say, hey, go get me, get me multispectral images of my field. And then we go back and, well, that's not what they say. They want to know where to plant or where to use fungicide and herbicide, and they need more nitrogen, which you can really pull this data apart because of all the spectrums that you're using and figure out what exactly – what parts of the field need what. So it's fascinating, and it's got a tremendous amount of potential.
Vince, let me ask you, the exemption that you've filed for under the Section 333, is that to provide training or for all those activities you just mentioned? What's the scope of your exemption?
There are several aspects that we have applied for. And one is, yes, pilot training, so that we can, again, when you go out into the field, you have to apply for a COA with the FAA. And a COA is a certificate of waiver or authorization. So you're asking them, you're saying, hey, you know what, I need NOTAMs, so I need to NOTAM out this field, and I'm going to operate at this particular place. So so you get your certificate of authorization, waiver or authorization. So pilot training, we would need to have a COA for that. Inspections, aerial inspections of power lines and pipelines, that is key. That's going to be a growing and booming industry.
Yes.
Precision agriculture, GIS, information system, you know, geological information systems. So finding out how much material has been removed from an open mine, let's say you can figure that out with photography. Those are just a handful of the operations that we plan to provide and services we plan to provide.
So Vince, what was the transition? Did you wake up one morning and decide that, gee, you know, this drone stuff is kind of fascinating and decide to make a company? How did you get into this?
Well, I fly single pilot. I'm a CJ2 pilot, and I fly single pilot and flying back from Morristown, New Jersey, back to Chicago almost three years ago now. And I had some time to think, and I said, well, where is this whole aviation industry evolving to? And I realized that, you know what, I'm just really a systems manager. I really don't fly this plane. I'm a systems manager. The industry, the technology is driving us to the systems that the military is using for their unmanned systems because of automation. You know, we're constantly talking about automation and how, you know, that's good and it's bad, but it certainly has made aviation safer. And it will continue to make aviation safer. So I realized, hey, I want to get involved in this expanding industry that really was just kind of in the background and kind of just talked about. Of course, you were hearing about predator strikes every day back then. So when I landed, I looked into advanced education. I have a bachelor's degree in kind of comprehensive sciences from Villanova University. And I said, well, it'd be great if I could get a master's degree. And I did some online research, and I said, well, I found this university, Unmanned Vehicle University, that offers master's degree in unmanned systems engineering. And a week after that, I was enrolled, and I started my classwork, and I'm within weeks of finishing up that master's degree in unmanned systems engineering. So, and then a year ago, I said, this is the pilot training is a key to this industry getting off the ground. And that's where we need to target. Vortex UAS needs to target the pilot training aspect of this because it is a key linchpin in this whole process and one that I believe is underserved.
So can you provide that training now or do you have to wait for the exemption from the FAA?
No, I mean, you can do classwork. You can certainly do classwork. And that's what we're doing. We, in fact, March 16th, we have an overview, a four-hour seminar on the fundamentals of what it takes and what the current situation is in the unmanned industry. And we go into the history of unmanned systems. We go into where the FAA is at right now, a lot of what we touched on just a few minutes ago. We talk about what are some other things that are really important about the unmanned systems. And I misspoke. It was May 16th. It's in 3 weeks, less than 3 weeks, not March. It's May. So that's what we're doing. And we're growing that into a full three-day course where we can take a pilot and bring them to a place where they're actually hireable by a company that has a 333 exemption. So that's where Vortex is right now.
You know, David Vanderhoof and I over at the UAV Digest, we refer to Rob as our favorite dronophobe. I don't know if you know that, Rob, but that's what we call you, our favorite dronophobe. because, you know, Rob's a pilot and he's got concerns and, you know, we've talked about them here. And
none of which you guys care about. Well, come on.
Okay, so, well, that's a good lead-in. So what's your biggest concern, Rob? And then, Vince, how do we address those kinds of concerns?
Well, my biggest concern, and honestly, you know, as I spoke to some folks when we had this seminar at Northwestern last week, and that's how I met Vince, actually, is when I saw the little drones that he had on the table. I said, I've got to go talk to this guy. And, you know, we got into some conversations. And seriously, the only thing that worries me is that right now the technology does not exist in order to keep drones away from airplanes and away from airports. And again, simply assuming that people are going to do it because they understand the rules does not, you know, that I'm afraid that's not enough to make me feel better. I mean, look at the idiots out there that have taken laser pointers beyond the realm of unbelievableness. Is that a word, unbelievableness?
It could be.
Okay, well, we just made up a new word. Seriously, and, you know, I don't worry about some of the real tiny ones that weigh less than a pound. I mean, there are certainly some, as you guys know, that will fit in the palm of your hand. I don't care about those. But the exemption that we're talking about would allow, and Vince, you tell me if I've got this wrong, if you had a 333 exemption and you had a drone, it could be, I don't know what kind, but something that weighs less than 55 pounds, you would be able to fly that. And that's the part that worries me, because I've seen what a 14-pound Canada goose can do to an airplane. And I can't even imagine what a 50-pound UAV would do if it got in the wrong place with an airplane. And all I've ever asked FAA, and I've never gotten an answer from this, I've never gotten an answer from the RTCA, which is the sort of the research group that's looking into this. Just tell me what you have planned to keep them apart. And I have not gotten an answer one from anybody about this, except that we're looking into it. So that keeps me completely off balance at this point. Now, Vince, you're way more involved with this than I am. You may know that there's something out there that I'm not even aware of. So please, I'll let you take it away if you do.
Now, I think, Rob, your concerns are valid. And I share those concerns, too. You know, we went into how being pilots and being passengers on commercial airlines, we don't want anything to happen. Of course, you know, jets, manned aircraft, we have TCAS. So we have that alert system that we can use to avoid other aircraft. Loss of control of UAVs is a primary concern for the FAA, and they state that in the NPRM. That needs to be addressed, some kind of sense and avoid, and that's the key in the industry. That's the buzz phrase in the industry, because as pilots, the fundamental separation, really, when push comes to shove, it's see and avoid. You see another aircraft, whether you're on an IFR flight plan or just flying around VFR, you see that aircraft and you avoid it. That is your fundamental responsibility as a pilot. Well, how do you do that as an unmanned aircraft operator? You can't see it. Well, that's why the visual line of sight requirement is what the FAA wants to implement, at least in this first round of rulemaking process. So that's one part of it. Another part of it is the automation of some kind of sense and avoid system. And there are, I can think of one system right now that has a burgeoning, some kind of sense and avoid system that they're implementing. And I don't know too much about it, so I don't want to talk about it. But that technology is being built and is really necessary for this technology to really mature and come of age. We have to be assured that those collisions are not going to happen. So I honestly share those concerns. People are working to solve those issues. And when that's going to be, who knows? Could be next week, could be 10 years from now. Don't know.
Yeah, the FAA is kind of starting out with the simple stuff, right? I mean, under the NPRM, Amazon.com can't do package delivery via drone. It's outside of the scope of the regulations that the FAA is proposing. But that's just the first step. So, you know, this is a really slow process, and it's something that's going to take years and years to develop. And the good part about that is it gives time for those technologies, those sense and avoid technologies, to be developed and mature and to become reliable.
And people are working on those right now. I mean, you look at TCAS. We haven't always had TCAS. TCAS came out of an accident with PSA and a 172 over San Diego. I know that, for example, NASA has two separate projects going on right here in my hometown of Mountain View at NASA Ames on traffic management for UAVs. So they've got one project for UAVs above 18,000 feet. They've got another project going on for UAVs below 400 feet. And then you look just across from them at Google. Google has announced that they're going to be doing ADS-B, and presumably that's for drones, for UAVs. So I think all of this stuff is in process and it is happening. But I will go back to see and avoid. You know, I think see and avoid probably should be called hope and pray. I mean, I don't know how many close encounters you folks have had flying out there, but I can tell you see and avoid does not work as well as everybody would like to believe. And you only have to go back to the accident back in the 1950s in the Grand Canyon, but two airliners climbing out of Los Angeles that crashed, I think it was around 1956. And boy, they didn't see and they didn't avoid. And that's when the big sky theory fell apart and they started designing radar to cover the entire country. So I think see and avoid is really hope and pray, but I think the technologies for separating UAVs from each other and from manned aircraft are, you know, well under development, and we're going to be hearing a lot about them very soon.
Well, I wish I shared your optimism, Max. I really do. And again, I'm not saying that it's not going to happen. I'm sure it will. It's just that, you know, we have not seen anything other than a lot of talk about it. And again, you know, the marketing lady from Vortex and I attended this event at Northwestern last week.
And Katie Glenn.
Katie, I'm sorry. I'm
that's okay.
We're like, she's, you know, like the third person, but Katie, who's sitting in the background there listening tonight. But, you know, and we were both, you know, almost overwhelmed at the first speaker they had, who was an attorney out of Washington, who represented Vince. I wish I could think of the name of that group again that we talked about last week, but again, a group that is basically focused on helping the industry get
AUVSI?
Up.
AUVSI?
No, I don't think it was. It wasn't okay. That group.
Good.
That's the one. No, that's the one that Katie and I talked about. But
yeah.
Different group. I've got it written down somewhere. But the point was that this man stood up in front of an audience of you know, maybe 70 or 80 people and talked about how this was coming. And don't worry about all the safety stuff. It's all going to get worked out. We're coming. And just get out of the way, FAA and all the regulators, because we can handle all this. We've got it all figured out. Just, you know, let us do our thing and let commerce, you know, take its own direction here, and it'll all be fine. Just shut up and get out of the way. And I think a lot of the people in the audience were kind of amazed, even one of the other presenters who is a pilot for one of the major carriers. And, you know, he said, I represent a company that builds these things, and I'm not quite so ready to go jumping off the edge of the cliff here, keeping my fingers crossed, which in that sense, Max West, I think you've got it absolutely right. I think see and avoid has always been hope and pray. And I don't think we want to go down that same road with drones, especially when we consider how many of them there are that are going to be out here flying pretty soon. And so, again, you know, TCAS, you're right that we didn't always have TCAS, but the airplanes were already flying at that point. We had some way to keep them apart. You know, TCAS was a better way. Right now, we don't have anything at all for the drones. And I think that's the part that's, at least to me, is kind of frightening.
Well, you know, this is an area where a lot of people have a lot of different concerns, questions, perspectives, and so forth. I noticed that as part of this NPRM that we've been talking about, the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, which applies to small UAS in commercial applications. The FAA had almost 4,000 comments submitted to this NPRM. And I don't know, Rob, have you got any concept of is that a lot? Is that not? I mean, it sounds like a lot of comments to me. 4,000
comments, and you realize that somebody has to go through all those things and then say, okay. Now, you know, they'll obviously, I'm sure they'll categorize them.
Sure.
But someone says, now what do we do? But, you know, and in the end, I think I just to go back to what you started with there, Max East, on, you know, you and David, and now we have Vince, who seems to be, you know, sort of on the same same perspective I am. I just wanted to kind of, you know, kind of bring this all together and give you my thought on, you know, on the UAV Digest perspective on this. So hang on.
I knew that was coming.
Yeah, I'm
sorry. How do you spell that?
Completely professional. I am so sorry. I thought I had the microphone turned off.
Yeah, right. There you go.
Just
hey, on the 4,000 comments, I did want to relate it to the ADS-B NPRM that was out a few years ago. At that time, and I was among a small group of folks who was working like crazy to increase the the number of comments that went in. We actually collectively set a record. There were more than 8,000 comments that came in on the ADS-B NPRM, which I understand was a record number of comments for NPRMs up to that point. It's intriguing to me that you've got roughly 200,000 pilots and probably more than a million UAV owners who would all have kind of a vested interest, and yet there were only half as many comments on this NPRM.
Yeah, I just checked regulations.gov, and of course the comment period has closed, although there have been some suggestions that they may extend that, but I haven't seen anything like that at this point. But anyway, they received 4,491 comments, so they went over 4,000 in the last day or so of the comment period. So we'll put a link to this in the show notes, point you to where you can see the NPRM at the regulations.gov website. But, you know, we could continue this conversation probably for an awful lot longer, but we probably are going to start running short of time. So with that in mind, Vince, can you tell our listeners where they can learn more about Vortex UAS?
Absolutely. VortexUAS.com. And there is also a Facebook page, Vortex UAS. So please visit us if you're in the Chicago area, and particularly if you are a pilot. We do have upcoming training, as I said, on May 16th, that is May 16th, at Chicago Executive Airport, Atlantic Aviation. Seats are limited. It's just going to be the start, and we see a training program and programs that will develop and give pilots the understanding, the knowledge, and the tools that they need to go out there and either take on a new career or just have supplemental income. Or maybe you're between jobs, you know, and you can do this on the side, make a little money, understand what's going on, or even if you just want to understand what's going on in the unmanned world, it's a great way to start. You know, it's just a simple orientation. It's $99, which is cheap when you come to these, you know, programs like this. So I encourage everybody who is interested to at least check out the website, check out the Facebook page, and if you're interested in unmanned training and you're in the Chicago area, please, you know, even give us, you know, email me, vince@vortexuas.com. That's another way to get a hold of us.
All right. And, you know, Vince, you kind of reminded me of something that I've advised, and David has as well, many others, is that, you know, if you're looking at getting into a career in aviation, or if you are interested in changing careers, either within or getting into aviation, I mean, how many opportunities do you have to get into something kind of at the ground floor? I mean, this is the beginning of something that I think is going to be gigantic, and it's going to represent a lot of what aviation is about in the coming years. So this is the opportunity to do that.
Right. You're on the ground floor. This industry, it's in its infancy. And for, you know, I would recommend to young people who are having trouble in the job market, look, this is an industry that's going to explode in the near future. And it's starting to explode already. And there aren't even rules that we can, you know, everybody and anybody can fly and get into this business in a service operational way. So if you have any interest in unmanned aviation whatsoever, now's the time. I mean, jump at it, because there are amazing, amazing opportunities. And you don't have to go out and get a graduate degree like I did. It just happened to be the way I approached it. But you do need some training and some skills, and to at least be able to speak the language, you know, because it is, as every industry has its own language, unmanned aviation has its own language.
Sure.
And to be able to speak about it intelligently and understand what people are talking about, the jargon and whatnot, and, you know, NPRM and Section 333 and all this stuff that we throw out like it's nothing, to be able to understand that, you really need the tools, the foundation, to be able to approach someone approach a company who is hiring. And trust me, there are companies that are getting these exemptions. They need pilots, and Vortex is going to provide those pilots.
All right. Vince Donahue, president of Vortex UAS. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 27th of April, 2015, and we're back.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 347. Yeah, sorry about that, Max. We actually thought the Bits and Pieces episode was last week, not, well, whenever it's coming up.
So, yeah, you mean...
Whoops.
You mean last week wasn't the holiday in the US.
Okay.
Oops, sorry. Oh,
well, you know, here in Australia, every weekend's a holiday. Isn't that right, Grant?
Well, actually, the weekend just passed felt like the first one I've had in quite a while. So, yeah, okay, yeah. Let's go with that. Every weekend's a holiday.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of people that are not taking a holiday, let's talk about the Minister for many things, including transport and infrastructure, Warren Truss. He's been out issuing a fresh statement of expectations, whatever that is, for CASA, the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, and SOE for CASA.
That's right, mate. Warren Truss, the Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for, industry, transport, aviation, all that kind of stuff, has written a publicly released letter to CASA that tells them the scope and direction that he wants them to take. And basically it's saying, tell me how you're going to implement the Forsyth Review, which was the Aviation Safety Regulation Review carried out last year, primarily in response to a lot of hoo-ha raised with the kind of not so good reporting on the Pell Air crash. And the ASRR came up, aka the Forsyth Review, came up with a number of suggestions. And Warren Truss has asked CASA to actually get on and enact how they're going to actually get around to changing as recommended. And I note, interestingly, that CASA's come around and said they're going to be open and honest with everyone in their commitment to deliver on the government's response to the review.
Well, that's a refreshing change. And many people might say that. CASA says, like Mark Skidmore, the new boss of CASA, has said a lot of things in response to this, including saying here, quote, CASA recognises positive engagement with the aviation community is necessary to develop and implement the best possible safety standards, deliver effective safety education, and get the right operational outcomes. Well, I'll tell you what, Grant, I hope that doesn't mean that he's actually going to further over-regulate our aviation sector, particularly when it comes to general aviation, because there's a lot of overkill in there already, in my humble opinion.
Mate, there's a number of delicate balances to be formed in this, but one of the things that seems to be coming up is that CASA are going to be asked to consider the economic and cost impact of regulation as well, in addition to implementing the Forsyth Review. So that could be a very welcome thing. A number of aviation groups within Australia are standing up and saying they're very happy that this is the results in terms of where the minister wants it to go, and that CASA is actually indicating they're going to do it. But of course, where the rubber hits the road, that's where we find out how it goes. That CASA are talking this is going to be between now and 2019, so we have a few years to see how they do it. And we've seen a number of requests for change start at the top and sort of fall apart by the time they get through that middle layer. So hopefully this one holds together and produces something that everyone can actually enjoy. Somebody has said that they're a little disappointed about the lack of harmonization of our regulations with international regulations. But CASA took that on probably the wrong direction when they said, oh, we're going to harmonize with international regulations. And instead of looking at the FAA, they looked at EASA.
Good
and
Lord.
Everyone knows EASA stands for Europeans Against Sport Aviation.
And I tell you what, Grant, in a sign of the times too, Skidmore also says here that they're considering long-term integration of remotely piloted aircraft into aviation operation in all classes of airspace. And particularly talking there, Grant, about commercial applications of remotely piloted aircraft. So a sign of the times, and obviously as there's, you know, this sector becomes more prevalent all around the world, and it's certainly playing a bigger and bigger role here in Australia every year. They certainly do need to be included in that. So that's all very interesting stuff. Now, Grant, let's talk about your favourite airline, Jetstar. They're doing something interesting at Avalon Airport down here in Melbourne. In fact, they're staying. That's probably good news.
I know. Contrary to rumours beforehand that they were going to shut down, which personally I think are similar to rumours of Ryan Airways looking at buying Airbus, it's a great way to get Boeing to react and give you a discount. And I think the rumours of them saying, stuff it, we're leaving Avalon, were a great way to get Victoria and even Lindsay Fox's Lynn Fox Group to step forward and make a better deal for them.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, this is, when you look at Avalon Airport, you're certainly setting themselves up as Melbourne's secondary domestic airport. But let's put that in perspective of the hundreds of flights that run in and out of Melbourne's main international airport every day. Jetstar currently is the only operator at Avalon. Currently, they only operate 5 services per day. They're making a commitment here to up that to 7 by introducing 2 more services up there to Sydney and looking at, over the next 18 months, adding 2 new domestic destinations. So that's interesting. The state government of Victoria has pledged $12 million over the next 10 years. And interestingly, Grant, Lynn Fox, who is currently the group that owns that airport, some of the news reports here today are saying that they're also looking at putting money in. So that's really interesting because they would also be charging Jetstar a bomb to use that airport. They certainly know how to crucify private pilots who would dare to use their airport and put their rubber on the runway and, bring some business into the airport and don't get me started.
Too late. so hang on. I knew I had my soapbox around here from the other week somewhere. Hang on, shall I find it for
you? Yeah, no, I tell you. I'm not a big fan of Lynn Fox. I'll just say that publicly. I've probably said it before. I don't like the way they treat general aviation. I just think they're part of the problem insofar as they just make things more expensive. But anyway, that's not really the gist of this story. That is good news. I think Avalon is a logical choice. It's a huge airport, sort of down towards Geelong, which is, about 70 or 80 kilometres to the south of Melbourne, and it really does make sense. I can see with some proper investment that airport really going ahead in leaps and bounds in the coming 10, let's say 20 years, I think. So it's a good thing that Jetstar is operating out of there. Now, I have had occasion to use Avalon Airport just once for a flight up to Sydney, probably about this time last year, actually. And, for a lot of people I talk to, we don't want to go to Avalon. It's so much further to drive all the way out there compared to Melbourne Airport. But I will say this much. Yes, it is further, but it's freeway all the way, and it's really only about another 10 or 15 minutes drive by comparison to driving to Melbourne Airport. And once you get there, being such a smaller airport, the experience actually is quite good, actually. It's much less hassle than going to Melbourne Airport, and the parking is cheaper, I'll tell you that much. A lot cheaper.
Yeah, look, it is a good thing. I note with some amusement that Jetstar does say that their Avalon services have been unprofitable, but given that that's kind of similar for many other parts of Jetstar's operation, I don't see this being a big problem for them to continue.
There we go. Well, soapboxes are plenty today. Grant, let's talk about something far more exciting. Let's talk about Squadron Leader Andrew Jacko Jackson, Australia's first qualified F-35 pilot.
Woo-hoo!
Legend.
Yeah, total legend. No, very happy. We knew this was coming. Jacko's been out there doing his sim sessions and then got to actually fly the aircraft not too long ago. And he's finally completed all his training missions and is now fully qualified as an F-35 pilot.
And a very quick transition there, it would seem, too, for Jacko. He finished that training at Eglin Air Force Base out there in Florida, and says here in this article on australianaviation.com.au that his initial flight was just back on March the 17th. So it's not only making him the first Australian to fly the F-35, he's the first Australian to be fully qualified to do it. And of course, he will be very heavily involved in training other Australian pilots to operate this aircraft. And as we've mentioned many times in the past, the F-35 is due to arrive here in Australia in 2018, 3 years away as we record this, and the first squadron, 3 squadron, will be operational in 2021. So lots of training to go for the F-35, but a really good start here, and really interesting. Some great photos too. I'll put a link in the show notes.
I agree, mate. It's great that he's up there, and be interesting to hear what he has to say about that rather large but apparently well-balanced helmet.
Yes, it does look very, very futuristic. Now, Grant, speaking of awesome flying, we should just do a quick plug for Wings Over Illawarra coming up this weekend. If you're anywhere on this side of the planet, if you're anywhere south of the international dateline, you need to be in Wollongong, just south of Sydney, this coming weekend, because Wings Over Illawarra is on. We're going to be doing the commentary again over 2 days. They're expecting something like 25,000 people to be there. And boy, am I a little nervous about that, I might tell you. But Grant, we're going to have everything from Air Force Hornets. We're going to have the Hercules there, the roulettes, the Russian roulettes. We're going to have warbirds. Oh, Paul Bennett's going to be there with his wolf pits and his Grumman Avenger. And oh, crikey, I think all of Australia's top aerobatic pilots are going to be there. It's going to be a really, really exciting weekend. Wingsoverillawarra.com.au. There you go, Grant. I sound like a radio announcer. I'm getting into the swing of it already.
There you go, mate. Well done. We, as you said, we're going to be doing the commentary. We'll be up in the commentary area sharing the space with Ando, Peter Anderson, voice of the Tamora Air Shows, also voice over at Omaka in New Zealand, and recently in Duxford.
I'll tell you what, Grant, talk about being nervous. I'm not sure if it's the prospect of standing in front of 25,000 people and doing commentary, or whether it's actually working next to aviation royalty like Peter Anderson. I'll tell you what, that is going to be a real privilege, and I'm nervous about it, but I'm looking forward to it, and it's going to be a fantastic weekend.
Yeah, well, the other part is that we're not just doing the commentary. Our team's also going to be there shooting the air show DVD. So hopefully this weekend we get lots of flying in, so we get lots of potential for DVD content.
Fantastic. Well, that's about everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. A big shout out to you, Mr. Vanderhoof. As I know, as we're recording this, Grant, he's just about to go in for his surgery, and I'm sure that as the podcast goes to air, he'll be recovering well. And I mean it, mate. You get yourself well, and I'm coming back there, and we're going to have more cheesesteaks. I tell you what, it'll be fantastic. Woo! That's a promise.
Make me jealous. Yeah. I miss my Philly's cheesesteaks.
All right, no problem. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
And by the way, it's Canoundra, not Canawindra. I thought you guys were used to places that don't sound anything like this spelt.
Oh, well. Can you say Tokemore yet?
I can say Arkansas.
Well, these guys have turned into like professional air show commentators. How do you get a gig like that?
It's starting to sound like the morning show of a radio station. I mean, these guys, they really sound like the morning team.
Yeah, they do. I forgot. I don't think we spoke to them since they did that air show commentary, at least not specifically, did we?
No, I think not.
No, I don't think so.
We ought to get them on one of these days to talk about that.
Yeah.
I do want to really get on them about something. I wish they had not mentioned Philly cheesesteaks, because my mouth is watering right now. I went to college in the Philadelphia area and lived on Philadelphia cheesesteaks. And literally, I just can't believe, you know, just the mention of them, you know, what it does.
Wow. All right. Now we have Rob's Aviation Minute. So let's listen to Rob.
From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute.
Now, I knew we had a lot of landing areas here in the United States, but 19,315 airports, heliports, and seaplane bases? Wow. No matter what you call them or what they look like, all these areas have one thing in common. They represent a place where airplanes, helicopters, and seaplanes all come home to roost from time to time. To me, some of those airports represent much more of an opportunity than simply as landing areas, though. In case you've been napping the past 10 years, the aviation industry is still suffering from an economic recession of sorts. In the early 1980s, on average, we produced 15,000 piston aircraft every single year. Last year, we produced 1,328. In the 1990s, we had over 700,000 pilots on the FAA's register. Today, that number's in the high 500s and still dropping. Student pilot starts are down too, with nearly 7 in 10 of them quitting long before they ever earn a pilot certificate. Aircraft maintenance technician numbers have seen zero growth since 1990. Worst of all, 75% of the AMTs around today are over the age of 50. As an industry, our ship has been taking on water for some time, despite a number of great initiatives designed to increase the pilot, mechanic, and airplane supply. If we don't figure out a way to start bringing new blood to the industry soon, though, there won't be enough people to fly the airplanes we build. or fix them, or service them at any of those thousands of U.S. airports. The question, of course, is what do we do about something that, well, many people still think is somebody else's problem? Rather than begin another new national program, what if we focused our triage efforts locally, like at our neighborhood airport? When people think of learning to fly, they go to the airport. If they want to buy a plane, they often visit the airport first. When they need their airplane fixed, or they want a hangar, they go to the airport. To me, airports are just natural magnets for aviation activity. This is why I think airport managers are the logical ones to help. Traditionally, these folks keep the airport alive with solid pavement, newly mown grass, and runway lights that work. All very necessary tasks, of course. But marketing the industry? That's not something airport people normally think about. But if airport managers started thinking more about marketing, I think they could transform their airports into a local industry beacon of sorts, one that encourages people to learn to fly or become involved in any of a half dozen other careers in the industry. I'm not asking airport managers to fix the industry's woes all by themselves, though. Just help coordinate efforts with the rest of the airport tenants, companies who need the boost as much as the airport does. Imagine the value of organizing a couple of career days, or even a couple of Young Eagles rallies. What about starting an airport Facebook page or a blog, one that tells the local community about the value of the airport, one that regularly posts photos or stories gathered from all the other airport tenants? Before you know it, hey, we might even convince the community around our airport to, well, ignore those 8-foot barbed wire fences and stop in for a visit. I realize it's easy for me to suggest that airport managers be up to the challenge of coordinating a local industry marketing effort, especially when there may not be an immediate return on the investment. So for those naysayers who have already decided that this will never work, I'd like to hear your ideas. But then my paycheck, as well as the paychecks of the people that work for us, really depend on the industry pulling out of this slump. And in case you don't think your paycheck does, I'd suggest you rethink that idea. But if we don't all start realizing that fixing what ails our industry is everyone's concern, from flight schools to FBOs to flying clubs to maintenance and avionic shops and more, we may just one day find that those airport managers who are still around, well, they may have a lot fewer airports to watch over. I'm Rob Mark. We'll see you next time. And by the way, if you don't already subscribe to the Aviation Minute, you'll find us on iTunes under Jetwine, or certainly you can visit our archive at jetwine.com.
Thanks, Rob, for that. Another fascinating Aviation Minute. Folks can subscribe to your Aviation Minutes, can't they?
They can. They can go to iTunes and find us there. They don't find it directly. I was still having a little issue with that. Sometimes it comes up under Jetwine. Sometimes it comes up under the Aviation Minute alone. It just depends on what kind of a day iTunes is having. But they can certainly subscribe if they go over to jetwine.com. But anyway, so that was just a few ideas on maybe some things we could be thinking about with our local airports.
Very good. Thanks again, Rob. Hey, a couple of, I guess you could call these administrative items. A couple of things. One is Instagram. Now, I know a lot of you know all about Instagram and have been using it for years or however long Instagram has been around, but we're kind of Instagram newbies. In Max Trescott, you've been sort of leading the charge when it comes to airplane geeks on Instagram.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the newbie department as well, but thought, hey, what the heck, might be fun. We get photos from time to time from our listeners, and some of these get posted on our Facebook site, some get posted on our website. But we just kind of thought, hey, why not use Instagram, since that's used a lot for sharing photographs. So I piloted an Instagram account for myself at Instagram.com/max.trescott, learned a little bit about it, made a few mistakes, and came up with what we think is a good plan that's going to work well for airplane geeks. So anybody who's on Instagram, you can find us, our first couple of test pictures up there at, Instagram.com/airplanegeekspodcast, all one word. And we're going to go ahead and ask you to send us some pictures this week. So I don't know. What do you think would be appropriate, Max, for our listeners to send us this week?
Well, we did talk about drones quite a lot.
I think that's a good idea. So why don't we just go ahead and pass along this offer. If you've got a good drone picture, and by that I mean something you've taken yourself or which your drone took, you know, either way, why don't you send it to us? So we've set up a new email address, Instagram@airplanegeeks.com. Now, we don't want stuff that you found on Google or on the web or stuff like that. We want only your best original creative work. So send it to us, and we'll post it on our account, and we'll tell you next week what happened.
Cool. Very good. Another item coming up, we have the annual Become a Pilot Day at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum at their Udvar-Hazy Center adjacent to Dulles Airport in Northern Virginia. And again, this year we've been invited back. Rob didn't misbehave too badly that they told us not to show up again. Thank you, Rob. And so we're going to be there. Now, this is always the Saturday before Father's Day. So this year, that's June 20th. Now, we like to plug this event, not only because we're going to be there, but because this is a fantastic opportunity to, well, bring your family, your friends, just immerse yourself in some amazing aviation exhibits, as well as the aircraft that fly in specifically for this. And again, we'll be there. We'll have a booth. We'll have a table set up inside. And we always do a dinner after the event Saturday. So we invite you to make plans to stick around after the event. Last year, Rob, I think we set a time that was too late. I think this year we ought to set dinner a little bit earlier. I think it'd be a little more convenient for folks to join us.
You mean you thought 1:30 in the morning was too late?
No. We did it like at 8 o'clock in the evening, and the show basically ends at, well, around 5, and so that was just too much time for people to for some people to stick around. But we usually have, well, I don't know, 12 or 18 people. I'm hoping that it won't be as dramatic as it was last year, Rob, where my brother sort of did a face plant in the restaurant. But no emergency crews this time, I hope.
Amen.
All right. Well, we would be normally moving on to some listener mail now, but I think we're running kind of long, guys. Maybe we're going to need to hold some of this over till the next week. Just really quickly, though, we'll mention that we had a number of different interesting comments posted in the website. You might want to take a look at that. Maria asked a question about learning to fly, getting your ticket, taking flight school, the expense of all that. And our guest from last episode, Michael Johnson, responded. He'll recall the founder and president of Paramount Aviation Resources Group. You can find that in the comments section. Kim Hayes brought up the AirCam. He says over $100,000 for this. How in the name of God can that cost be justified? For that cost, you could pick up a 172, some 182s, a Cherokee, Navion, even some Bose. What's a Bose?
Good question. But I was going to say, Ken, I think we're comparing apples and oranges, because if you're saying an AirCam, a new $100,000, well, let's see, a Cessna 172 is just about $300,000 new. So I don't think this is a very fair comparison.
Besides, what's as crazy as an AirCam? I mean, how could you not be excited about something like an AirCam? I guess if you want a real airplane, maybe, but something with it that's enclosed. But if you like the wind in your face, man, an AirCam seems like the ticket.
Well, and it can do some things that none of the other airplanes mentioned can do. You know, it's nice to have that second engine when you're down low over the jungles, which is what the plane was originally designed for.
Yeah, absolutely. Ken sent in a link. This is a YouTube video. We'll put this in the show notes. Worst place to be a pilot. And this is from a UK program, a Channel 4 program. It's about flying in Indonesia. I think it's an episode of some kind of a program or something. This has got some crazy, crazy flying. Well, the flying's not crazy. It's the landings and takeoffs from some of these unimproved airstrips perched in mountains, just on the knife edge of a. Yeah, it's just crazy stuff. But it makes for interesting watching. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. All right. Well, with that, we'll say thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. This has been episode 347. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. You can find the show notes there as well. Or if you want to go to them directly, it's airplanegeeks.com/347. I want to thank our guest, Vince Donahue, president of Vortex UAS. You can find us on all the usual places. Just look for Airplane Geeks on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, also Stitcher.com and TuneIn Radio. If you want to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. If you'd like to check out our brand new budding Instagram page, again, that's instagram.com/airplanegeekspodcast. Okay, Max Trescott, tell our listeners where they can find more of you.
Well, if you're out at Palo Alto Airport in the afternoon, you might see me out there here in sunny California. But online, you can find me on Facebook.com. Just search for Max Trescott. Or if you're looking for any of the books that I write, you can take a look at G1000book.com.
And Rob Mark, how about you online? Where do we find more of you?
More of me. Yeah. Now, who would want that? Good question. David would be saying. See, I don't know. I don't think we even need David back because I can I can do David's part. I can be, you know, irreverent. So
yes, but do you know aviation history?
Yeah, well, that's right. I don't know anything about aviation history except that it happened a long time ago. Jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter, Jetwine the blog on Facebook, the Aviation Minute, I don't know, and who knows where. So just so long as, I always say, so long as it's not on the wall of the post office.
All right, very good.
You know what, I'll bet you I'm so old these days, no one even gets that joke anymore.
You know, it's funny, we're talking about that recently, and my kids don't know what that was, so yes, you're right.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. And we'll ask all of you to join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
All right. Well, this ought to be fun because we're going to learn everything there is to learn about avs, ovs. We could call them ovs. Couldn't we call them ovs?
No, Rob, no.
No. Yeah. That's like my grandmother calling the UPS man the ups guy.
The ooavs or ooasses?
Yeah.
That might be bad.
That would.
Yeah. I didn't think about that before I said it, so I won't say it again.
Hi, Max. Oh, there's more than one Max.
Yeah, there is.
Now, okay.
I know.
It used to be confusing when there was just one Max, but we simplified that and added it to the show.
That cleared things
up. Thank you for making it less confusing.
Please take out that incredibly rude comment I made, unless, of course, you don't want to. It's up to you.
It's always up to me.
I was impressed by the sophistication of Rob, emoting on his feelings. But nonetheless, it was delightful.
Well, he's a guy. What do you expect?
That's very highbrow.
Okay.
Hey! Before you start, have you switched your downloader off? I can always tell.
Here we go. Here we go again. Oh, it could also be Nikolai. Hang on.
Now, as I mentioned the other week, folks, Grant would never be illegally downloading content from the internet because that would be naughty. He's just going off to make himself a Long Island iced tea because that wouldn't be illegal. Now back to your regular programming. Anyone for tennis? You know, a funny thing happened on the way to the studio today.
And I'm back.
And then I said, oh, hi, Grant.
Hi. Hi. You know, not all torrents are used for pirate stuff.
How do you know I was talking about that?
What else?
I was talking about your drinking habit.
There you go. Torrents are like hammers. Hammers can be used for good, but they could also be used for evil. Should we outlaw hammers because they can be used to cave in skulls?
Oh, I like it. Jeez, you should get a job in media for the National Rifle Association.
There you go. Hey, when all you have is the hammer, every problem looks like a skull.